The last word I heard is, the last estimate is 1,600, or 4 o'clock this afternoon. That's always subject to change, but they were refueling en route. They're flying the Gulfstream.
Sir?
Yes.
I had two questions. Do the allowance of the tankers back into the port have anything to do with the inadequate crude oil storage at Alyeska? And the fact that they can't hold the oil because they have 18 tanks rather than the 32 approved number?
I wouldn't present it to me that way. I think it was more a question of the refineries down south saying you've got to start the flow again. That's the way it was presented to me. They slowed down the flow in the pipeline so they could compensate for this time when they would not be able to move it out. I know there were two in there. I don't know what the status of those two are as far as the loading, but it was not presented that way. It was a different twist on it, if you will.
Our understanding here is that Congress approved for 32 holding tanks, and they have only 18 at the present. And I was told that that was something that was contributing to the allowance of tankers back in so soon after the spill.
Probably the fact that that's not the way it was presented to me as the reason.
Okay. One other question. We know that the pilots used to take the tankers all the way out through Hinchinbrook. Is this going to be reconsidered now, considering this incident, that the pilots not get off at Rocky Point, that they continue on further out?
I honestly can't answer that. I'm sure that'll be a question that'll be raised and maybe addressed, but I really don't know the answer. But we do have the National Guard resources that have been provided to us by the through the state when the governor declared a disaster area. I don't know that we're lacking resources, considering the number of that have been brought in by Exxon and by the state and by the Coast Guard. I don't think it's a lack of the resources. We're certainly going to move them from all over. Later on, that's certainly something we would consider. I'm sure we'll take help from any direction, because that's not going to be the fun part when you're slogging around in the oil.
Based on what you know, what is the current status of the spill, and what are your top priorities right now?
Top priority right now is the protection of the hatcheries and that sensitive economic zone, or the ecologic zone. The number two priority is cleaning it up. Those are the ones that we're facing jointly. Now, obviously, that the cleanup is going to be follow-on. It's ashore now. The next thing you do is get it off, but I'm not sure that's as quite as important as Mr. Iorosi's problem of salvaging that tanker, making sure that is able to be removed from the reef.
Coast Guard's in charge of these cleanups all around the world involving American oil. Have you found anything in this spill that's different in terms of its characteristics and trying to clean it up as compared to other ones?
No, as a matter of fact, we're kind of back to the classic spill, if you will, and that all changed night before last. Before then, there was a massive thing, as you know, and we're looking at means of, such as dispersant and burning and trying to contain this what eventually became about 100 square miles. That's a lot of oil, and as you know, it probably happened in 5 hours. Stopped bubbling. The massive thing was done, boom, right now. That was rather difficult. Once that wind came up and started putting in the windrows and driving to shore, it was sort of back to the kind of thing we usually face. Not on the same scale, but that's sort of the classic problem.
How many miles shoreline are now affected?
Well, we'll describe that, but I don't, unless you want to embarrass me by running my fingers out here and estimating distances, you'd have to tell you it's all around night and how to make it, and these islands that Mr. Dietrich outlined for you. I'm sure we can run a measurement on it for you. I'll be happy to help if I get some dividers.
What is the dimension of how
many
miles?
I'm sorry?
Area square miles.
Can we say how far the leading edge is from the original spill site?
Well, I mean, that's changing as we speak here, and Larry might be able to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he has the most update information. Our last edge down there this morning, but to my knowledge, it was
to
the southern end of Knight Island, I believe.
How far is that mile?
I'm sorry.
How many miles is that from the...
From here?
No, from the spill. From the meltdown.
Well, from the spill, we were saying yesterday that it was about 30 miles. It was probably 35 or 40. Now, would that be accurate, Larry?
Yeah, I think it, that one storm, the leading edge of the pancake went from its original position to the farthest front. Heard somebody ran a number and thought it moved 37 miles overnight up to 11 that morning.
When I was out yesterday, we estimated the edge was about 30, and we came in around midday, and we figured from an earlier flight in the morning, the pilot said he estimated it was running about 1.3 to 1.5 knots.
So you had all the equipment that you needed now to clean up the oil?
Well, except for the manpower-intensive slogging on the beaches, but as far as the cleanup, no, there'll have to be more things brought in to do the cleaning, the pads, and that sort of thing, but it's not that it's not available.
What about skimmers? I know the Navy has skimmers that will break apart and go into a C-130. Are those coming here?
We have skimmers either here or coming.
They're in.
What's going on with NCS today? Are you questioning the captain and crew, or have they already done that?
Well, the Navy finished. I met the people this morning, just when they're coming in, and I don't know if they've finished their investigation, but I know they talked to them this morning, maybe 2 hours ago.
To the captain or to the crew, to everyone? Who?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. My question was phrased wrong. You know that they talked to the captain this morning or to all crew members this morning?
The three people that I met for the first time were the captain, the third mate, and the first mate. And they were on their way in to talk to the NTSB. I'll tell you, my ears are getting awfully old. I didn't miss that.
Have additional subpoenas been issued to make other crew members available then for the investigation, other than the addition of the four that were initially issued?
I don't know.
Did you decide on the number of people left in manpower that Coast Guard is using right now? Manpower and equipment.
We've got the Cutter Rush, which has got about 150 people on there, and available as a command and control platform if we need it. It's there for other purposes as well, maybe search and rescue or whatever we need it for. It was pulled off law enforcement patrol to come up here to use that way. We've got the Cutter Sedge, which is a buoy tender with roughly 55 people aboard out of Homer. That's the one that met the fishermen when it came over and helped deploy those booms. We've got two H-3 helicopters, normally out of Kodiak with their crews. We've got an H-65, that's the Dolphin helicopter out of Kodiak. We have a Falcon from Air Station Cape Cod here with FLIR and the infrared, if you will, as well as the side-looking radar. And of course, we'll have the team coming in with a commandant today.
I think this can describe it as the biggest that has occurred here
in certainly North America since we've been keeping records on oil pollution.
I'm saying it's the manpower twice anything we've seen before.
Well, I think it's pretty a massive effort, but some of those probably a little different, and it's going to be, as we suggested, it'll be manpower intensive doing a cleanup, and that count wouldn't be in yet. There'll be a lot of shoreline to be clean.
Will it continue at night? Is the work, the cleanup work, able to continue at night, or does it stop?
Some of it can continue. You know, like the skimming was going the other day, that can continue. As far as walking the beaches, that's...
going on at night? Has any effort been going on at night?
Well, some of it, except when the wind came up. You know, then people were trying to take shelter, and I don't think anybody argued with that. It was pretty nasty.
Has he been reporting this afternoon? Will they be reporting to us this afternoon?
I don't know. I talked to him earlier, and they will report as soon as they've done something. I understand the hearing is going to start Tuesday morning in Anchorage. That's the only thing I've heard as far as the actual hearing.
But will they be reporting to us this afternoon? Will they be giving a press conference today? Do you know?
If I could just step in a moment. I think Admiral Nelson plans to stay around here a bit longer. And I'd like to make sure that Mr. Devins and Mr. Iarossi have a chance to comment. And if you'll be willing to answer a few more questions in case people have them.
Whatever.
Thanks. John? John Devins is the mayor of Valdez.
Well, I appreciate an opportunity to speak here today. I'll keep it very brief because I know some of you are trying to hit deadlines. I'm here to represent the city's interests. It's very difficult after 5 days of this not to express some anger or frustration, and I'm going to try and keep that down because I believe that's really non-productive at this time. Right now, I think we have to figure out how we're going to get that oil cleaned up and how we're going to save as much as we can at this late date. Valdez is a transportation site, not just an oil city. We're not really an oil city. We just happen to transport more oil than we do other things. But we also have been very supportive of the oil and gas industry. We've supported the development of oil and gas in the state of Alaska. And now we feel a little betrayed, but that doesn't inhibit us in terms of recognizing the fact that the oil industry has been very good to Valdez, with this one major exception. We're very interested right now that the oil industry lives up to its promises to us. Over the years, we've been promised that they would do everything possible to protect us from an incident such as has happened, that they would have a quick response team that would get out there. In fact, within 5 hours, there should have been a response team out there. And that they would do everything in their power to keep from interfering with our fisheries industries, our tourism industries, and our quality of life. I think it's quite clear right now that this area, not just Valdez, but possibly Cordova and Tetitlic and possibly even Whittier, are faced with destruction of our entire way of life. This oil must be cleaned up, and it must be cleaned up as soon as possible. That sounds kind of ironic since we're now into the fifth day, and in our view, there really has been very little of substance that has been completed. The city of Valdez has made repeated offers over the years to help by stockpiling materials for just this type of an incident. We've always been told when we've made these offers that we shouldn't waste our money on this, that the oil companies were ready for a major disaster. I think it's quite clear now that that hasn't been the case. We've been promised for the last several days that all reasonable costs will be covered. We're not exactly certain what all reasonable costs are, but we're very concerned that not only our fishermen are cared for in this case, but we have other industries out there that are going to be impacted severely by what has happened. Our processors, our support industries, our tourism industry are all going to be impacted, and we hope that Exxon will honor their pledge, and we hope that the President of the United States will see fit to make a declaration of disaster for this area, because we're afraid that when all is said and done, that maybe when those of you of the press find something else to interest you and you leave and go home, and there's no longer an eye on Valdez, maybe some of the commitments will not seem as important. And we're very concerned about that. We hope that we have the support of not only the Exxon company, but also the President of the United States, because we're going to have a lot of industries that are going to be impacted here for a lot of years. Thank you.
Although we have talked today mostly about defensive measures to keep oil out of critical habitats and critical areas for fishermen, such as the hatchery sites and the related areas, one of the real sleeping giants that occasionally moves a bit that we're very concerned about is keeping the oil that remains on the Exxon Valdez, in the Exxon Valdez, or better yet, to move it into the Exxon Baton Rouge so that we don't have the risk of more oil lost into the Sound. We think that's a very high priority, even though it doesn't get a lot of conversation. And I know that Mr. Iarossi is prepared to speak to that, as well as perhaps to add his comments on the new approach being taken here.
I'd like to begin by speaking a little bit about the activities going on to protect the environment from that started to be 1 million barrels of oil on that vessel. I know and it's absolutely correct and reasonable that everybody's attention is focused on the oil on the water, and boy, we've got to hit that with everything we can. And that has been an absolute priority of ours. At the same time, we have been doing everything we can to remove the further threat represented by those by the 1 million barrels of oil on the vessel. Our response team is now up to 150 members. That's Exxon and Exxon contracted managers, supervisors, and experts, 150 people. With regard to the lightering operation, we now have 225,000 barrels of the cargo off. That was as of noon today. That's roughly 22.5% of our problem. We have six pumps in operation. Our average pumping rate right now is 7,700 barrels an hour. We have six additional pumps, or we'll have six additional pumps on board by 6 p.m. tonight. We'll have a total of 10 pumps in operation by noon tomorrow, and we estimate our pumping rates, our transfer rates, will be up to 12,000 barrels an hour. And we will complete the transfer of approximately 500,000 barrels of that cargo to the Baton Rouge tomorrow afternoon if we continue to make the progress that we are now. At that point, we will have removed 50% of the threat posed by that the cargo remaining on board. We have the Exxon San Francisco position to come in behind the Baton Rouge, and she should be in a lightering operation with the Valdez by Thursday morning. If all continues to go well, we should have all the cargo off the damaged vessel by Saturday at this time. Once we have the oil transferred from the damaged vessel, we will be ready to begin to refloat the tanker. Our salvage plan involves first creating an air seal at the main deck of the vessel. And in order to do that, we have to remove a number of fittings and apertures which protrude through the deck. We have to blank those off because we intend to pressurize the airspace in the cargo tanks. We have blanks of every size needed being manufactured in Portland. They're going to be flown up, and we'll be on the vessel tomorrow. And we'll start the process of creating that air seal while the last phase of the lightering is going on. Once we have created that air seal, and we are satisfied we have the operation totally under control, and the Coast Guard will be working with us, and the state and all of the other cooperative activities we have going on, at that point we'll be ready to begin to pressurize the cargo space of the vessel. We have in all those damaged tanks a water block, because all those tanks will remain flooded with what will then be a predominantly seawater and with still some oily water mixture in it, and we will pressurize those tanks and refloat the vessel. We'll be using first the vessel's inert gas system. We'll supplement that with the vessel's air compression system, and we also have brought aboard some air compressors to portable air compressors to finish the pressurization if needed. We feel increasingly confident that we will be able to refloat the damaged vessel. We're lining up to, as soon as we can get it refloated and moved, to have a very, very thorough diver survey of the underwater surface of the vessel. We need that. We don't know anything about the condition of the vessel where it is currently resting on the pinnacle. Now, obviously, the divers weren't able to get anywhere around that, and we have actually cautioned them to stay away from the pinnacle, because the vessel, at least on Sunday, there was some slight motion with the vessel. Since it pivoted around early Monday morning, it's in a much stable condition, but we still
have drawn a pretty wide berth around that that pinnacle. So we need to get a good look at what the damage is in that location, and then we'll know where we proceed from there. Just to add a little bit to Larry Dietrich's comments, we have 20,000 feet of boom available for the different operations that are going on. We have 12,000 feet of boom in the air en route to Valdez. We've also got 12 skimmers being repositioned. Let me just add to some of the other comments made this morning. We first met with Jack and the other members of the fishermen's group on Saturday. They identified a number of sensitive areas, which were then at the east of the location of the spill, and they felt that they were the most directly threatened areas. That evening, we hired a number of fishing boats, I don't know if it was two or three, and first light Sunday morning, those boats repositioned those booms to the areas which were then along the eastern side of the spill. Galena Bay is the only one specific area I remember. I don't remember the names of the others. Saturday afternoon, we met with Admiral Nelson and then with Dennis Kelso and his folks and received their concurrence to a broad-based attack on that large slick, which was then just south of the vessel or the location of the grounding. It was a broad-based attack which included all the resources we had available to us. We were planning to use dispersant in Zone 1 to burn along the outer edges where it threatened sensitive areas. In particular, I think Naked Island was one area. We didn't want to disperse in that area, so we were using one of our other tools, which was ignition, and we were going to continue the skimming operations along the leading edge to the south and southeast. And we were all ready to go. First thing Monday morning, however, from Sunday night to Monday morning, our entire plans were turned around by very, very high winds, much higher than forecast. Gusts were up to 73 miles an hour, as it's been reported to me. I got that figure from the terminal at the air station, or the airport that lost part of its roof. So that was a real upset to us. And we spent from Monday at noontime, which is when we got our first aerial surveillance. I was getting the data from my group at the same time Admiral Nelson was from his group. He called me on the phone, and we got together began to try to reorient the attack. We have spent all of that time since Monday noon through to very late in the morning. It is Tuesday, isn't it? Tuesday morning. To begin to reorient the attack, and we are now back where we can take the initiative. Larry pointed out the approach we're using. We're back to using the three methods available to us. We're going to be dispersing only in Zone 1. Unfortunately, the bulk of the oil is out of that area, so it really increases the need to be using ignition and skimming, and all that will be in operation in full swing. Some of it is going on right now. Thank you.
Mr. Ivanoff, in your rundown just now, you seemed, unless I missed it, to go from the Saturday plan to the Monday setback. When Mr. Cornett talked to us earlier today, he characterized Sunday as a real missed opportunity. And when we asked him why the opportunity was missed, he seemed to say that there was some problem between Exxon and the DEC as far as the question of dispersal. Have you and the DEC since then been able to come up with some idea that we can have on what was happening Sunday when the weather was good, that more wasn't done on this problem?
Yes. We had our first, let me just make sure we put this all in order.
I arrived Friday night with eight other people. Saturday morning, which was the second day for us, we began moving all our, we had to move. We got in Saturday night because we came by corporate jet. The rest of the team began moving from commercial jets. They got to go to Anchorage. They overnighted Friday night in Anchorage. First thing Sunday morning, they were up in the air to Valdez. They started arriving here at our center. I guess it was about 9 o'clock. Between 9 and 12, we got ourselves organized. By 12, we were in full stream, and by 6 that evening, that's Saturday evening, we had taken full operational responsibility from Alyeska for all the cleanup activities, and we were really moving at that point. Two important things happened late Saturday. We had our first dispersant test. Unfortunately, the light conditions were so poor that because of the cloud cover and the lateness of the afternoon, that we were not able to visually identify the full effects to everybody's satisfaction. So we scheduled two more tests for Sunday of dispersants. The first one was mixed results. The second one was spectacular. We have a video of it. And the reason there were different results was because we had different we were using different spray techniques in order to determine which was the most effective. At the time, we were using two planes, and we had them organized a little differently. So one was mixed results. One was just spectacular results. Those results were reviewed with the Coast Guard and with the state officials Sunday afternoon, and by 6:45 p.m. Sunday, we had a total concurrence plan. You know, it may appear that we now have a coordinated activity. We have had a coordinated activity. We had a concurrence plan as of 6:45 Sunday night. It was
long. Is that what you're saying? There's no way that you can look back and see that that could have been sped up at all?
Well, I believe that there are a lot of sensitivities, a lot of education that needs to go on. A lot of bases that has to be touched, and I'm not sure it could have been sped up much unless we just had total blanket concurrence to come in here and hit it from the first step. And I'm not you know, there's difference of opinion. There's a lot of people involved. There's a lot of interests involved. And many of the people involved, particularly the local inhabitants in the fishing area, fishing people, they don't understand all of these different mechanisms. And I think to some degree, they need to feel comfortable before you hit it hard. Problem is, this was such a massive spill that seconds were important.
When did you have that all arranged prior?
It is prearranged.
Was this the continuum?
It is.
You mentioned that you had to touch bases, there had to be education done, and so on. Why isn't that taken care of?
It is pre-planned, and there are pre-authorizations.
Why did it take so long to go through this? Why did we have to wait two days to get it all in place?
I really don't want to speculate on it.
Can you describe to us
there will be a time to do it.
Can you describe to us your contingency plan?
People of Alaska?
No, not at all.
Because you're money motivated. You and your company are money motivated to help with Alaska and Alaskans. That's a third world country.
Let me handle that by saying that I totally disagree with you. And I want to hold the floor for another second.
Long before this ever happened, you've been told for years about this. You refuse to do anything about it. What's wrong? Don't you want to give up 1 point of your profit margin to make sure you have the equipment in place?
I think you got obviously something on your mind, but you directed it at the wrong person.
You're in charge, aren't you?
I'm in charge of Exxon Shipping Company.
Let me step in. I realize it. I'd like to ask that you save that for Exxon prime time and give us a chance to finish up somewhere or other. I realize there are strong feelings about this, and I'd like to clarify something as well on the issue of dispersants, and that is that the use of dispersants in Zone 1, which is roughly this area, is pre-approved at the discretion of the on-scene coordinator. The State Department of Environmental Conservation and the other participants in the regional response team have considered ahead of time the possible use of chemical dispersants, and the use in Zone 1 is pre-approved. That's based upon distance from shorelines, depth of water, likelihood that adequate dilution will occur from the use of dispersants, and lack of sensitivity of that particular part of the water column, or at least less sensitivity than if it were in other areas, which we've identified as Zones 2 and 3. I heard a report, which I don't know the accuracy of, that a statement was made that DEC had delayed the use of dispersants. That is not correct. It is true that DEC does not support indiscriminate use of chemical dispersants. However, we do support the Zone 1, 2, and 3 designations, and we support looking at, first of all, the use of mechanical recovery where it can be effective. If it cannot be effective, then look at the other tools on a case-by-case basis. In the use of chemical dispersants, you have the potential for resource trade-off, damage to certain resources that could be more heavily affected by oil on the surface of the water versus potential impacts on resources that could be affected if that oil is distributed at some depth in the water column. We're just suggesting that be looked at carefully, case by case, and in this instance, the decisions made on dispersants were made in a timely way, and they were available ahead of time. DEC was not the bottleneck. We will continue to say we don't support indiscriminate use, but the situation in this case indicated that use in Zone 1 could be appropriate, and we left that to the on-scene coordinator.
Why do you object to the use of dispersants in shallow area? What are these the specifics of this trade-off that we keep hearing about?
So let me give you just a general view, but I think it would be most useful if I put you together with Brad Hahn from our staff, who can give you much more of a picture. Essentially, what you have is when you have oil on the surface of the water, you have a toxic element there in the form of the oil, and it floats along. It maintains a kind of surface tension because of the attraction of the particles of the oil, and when you use a chemical dispersant, that chemical breaks up that tension, what is called the interfacial tension. So instead of this smooth sheen that we are so accustomed to seeing, you have a bunch of disconnected particles that can then be distributed within the water column rather than floating on top, adhering to each other. That means that, for example, an oily sheen that floats inshore where herring will soon be coming into spawn may have a really serious effect, because it slides in, it settles down onto vegetation or into the gravel, it gets down in between the spaces, and for a long time that can continue to kind of bubble up, bleed out from between those spaces where it has settled, and it can have a really serious impact.
if you determine that you might want to use a chemical dispersant, you're deciding whether by breaking up that surface and distributing it to some level within the water column, that may have less of an effect. In addition, there is the potential of the chemical dispersant itself adding some level of toxicity to the overall mix. I don't want to give you the impression that we're saying that chemical dispersants are poison to fish. I don't mean that, but there may be an additional toxic contribution. So we're not saying you can't use them in any circumstance. We're just saying use them carefully and target them in areas that you're not likely to do additional damage.
On that line, when you're talking about using these dispersants, for example, when the Glacier Bay accident occurred in Cook Inlet, there was a decision made not to use dispersants there. That took place within about 2 weeks of the time that DEC approved the contingency plan for Alyeska here in Prince William Sound. Do you think that there was a lack of oversight then on DEC's part, given the fact that in Glacier Bay it was made clear that there was a concern about the salmon and therefore non-use of dispersants, to go ahead and approve a plan that relied heavily on the use of dispersants in an area where you've got critical fish habitat?
The situation is very different in Cook Inlet, and the decision there was based on the factors occurring at the inlet at the time. You had salmon spawning actually going on. There were high levels, high populations of salmon moving into the freshwater streams to spawn. That's a very high energy environment. The tides in Cook Inlet are very high and very powerful. They move back and forth and carry heavy sediment loads with them. The decisions there were based not only on the potential for impacts on the resources, but also on the likelihood of success. And in the Cook Inlet situation, there was very early bonding of oil to sediments and oil to debris, which quickly moved it out of the sheen or slick characteristics that allow you to use chemical dispersants. For example, a chemical dispersant really is most effective when it's applied to a spill in its early stages, when there's still a light fraction of the aromatics and where it hasn't weathered off. And the maximum depth thickness is about 1 millimeter. So you can't use it in every circumstance, and the cooking situation is quite different. In this situation, bear in mind that what we're talking about in the pre-approval was just in Zone 1. Zones 2 and 3 still require affirmative approval by DEC. That doesn't mean that we wouldn't utilize it in some instances. In fact, there is a Zone 3 application pending right now that we believe is appropriate to use in a limited area. But again, the idea is target it so you don't run a greater risk of having more impact than you would have if you hadn't used it. And that's how we're operating.
Now because you didn't use it?
I'm sorry.
Do you think that there is more impact now because it has gone ashore in such quantities because you didn't use dispersant earlier on Sunday when Exxon asked to?
Well, the approval from us was in place. So
5 p.m. Sunday figure, and then we got that from Mr. Conrad. He said that DEC did not approve use of dispersants until 6:45 p.m. Sunday, although Exxon had requested it from the time of the spill.
I don't know what area he was suggesting.
Zone 1.
If it was in Zone 1, then it's simply a matter of, if that statement was made, it's just a matter of being misinformed, because that Zone 1 pre-approval was been in place for a long time.
On that?
But remember, it's the on-scene coordinator.
Exxon did have permission to use dispersants and chose not to do it on Sunday.
Remember, it's the on-scene coordinator from the Coast Guard that has the final call in Zone 1.
Well, but I'm asking Mr. Iarossi now, did Exxon ask for permission to use dispersants when they had pre-approval to do so?
Yes.
Why?
Absolutely. Yes.
Why? You had pre-approval.
I'm sorry, I thought you asked if we did ask for permission. We did not have pre-approval. We do not have pre-approval.
About pre-approval then?
The pre-approval rests with the on-scene commander, which is the Coast Guard. Exxon did not receive permission to use dispersant in Zone 1 until 6:45 p.m. Sunday night.
Did the Coast Guard issue earlier than that?
hanging up on.
I can understand why it's confusing. Here's the deal.
The regional response team, which includes the federal agencies, the State Department of Environmental Conservation, and we always consult with the State Department of Fish and Game, considers these zones, for example, and authorizes the on-scene coordinator, the Coast Guard, to make the decision on whether to say that use in Zone 1 is acceptable. Mr. Iorossi is correct that until the on-scene coordinator says go, they do not have permission to apply chemical dispersants. But the Coast Guard does have that authority in Zone 1 because we've already pre-approved it and they don't have to come back to us.
Admiral Nelson, it's, you know.
Well, could you try and answer?
Somebody was slow, it sounds
like. You hear, sir, what Mr. Kelso is saying. Now, was there any kind of hesitancy on the part of the Coast Guard on letting Exxon use these dispersants?
The regional response team is chaired by a member of my staff. As Mr. Kelso said, it has representation from ADEC, the Fish and Game, the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is federal. In other words, federal and state representation. These zones are, say, pre-planned, if you will. They shift a little bit with time. Each time, you know, with the season, I should say. When, before we can, the chairman of the RRT or the RRT can give the on-scene coordinator the okay, he's got to touch base with every single agency on the regional response team. I can tell you they spent one whole lot of time doing that, getting that first okay to use a dispersant. And all the considerations, some of which have been aired here, I don't know which, what turn you want to put on it, but I learned a lot the other night when I heard about oil, the biodegradability and how the dispersants acted on them. I thought, on the basis of what I had heard for years, that it sank to the bottom all the time. Heard the other night that it only goes down 5 inches. So the principal concern is getting into the tidal region where 5 inches would be more critical in the deep water. But all of these concerns are expressed and back and forth before the people finally get the agreement. Yesterday, when we got an approval for the use, if necessary, if absolutely essential, in Zone 3, they were all prepared to go out there, and it got called off in the last minute because the conditions weren't right. There was no value to do it at the moment, but they were on scene prepared to do it. That was a remarkable, I say remarkable, that's me speaking my own judgment on that response to turn that thing around. But we said we want to do something, the situation is critical, we want okay. But I can tell you there's an awful lot of phone calls, a lot of work going on trying to get that coordination, get that approval.
Mr. Cornett of Exxon called Sunday especially a major missed opportunity to do this cleanup, to get started on. Where do you feel that happened? Is it because the process is just too cumbersome to respond quickly?
I don't think it's a question of being all that cumbersome. There were some attempts made. And as Mr. Iorossi said, the one was, it was inconclusive because they didn't have a good light to determine where that first pass at the C-130. The second one, they figured it was a bust. The spray from the DC-6 was not adequate. And each time they did this, of course, they come back and report back. They got to fill the aircraft and have them come out. The last time when he said it was fantastic was that the best shot was a C-130. But even then, my on-scene coordinator, Commander McCall, was flying overhead in a spotter on that thing, and he's used trying to describe the situation by saying it's like throwing a toothpick into a swimming pool when you're talking about the area that got covered in that short period of time. And I think the best estimate we got was if on one pass you go about a mile north and by five swings you'd probably get maybe 5 square miles or 5 miles in. So if you had the full load, you maybe get 10 square mile area. And you know, each one of these was based on let's give it a shot, see what happens with it. And they had to go back each time and get an okay to do it.
Think maybe are hopefully pretty straightforward. The pre-approval, is that for just testing or for just the wholesale use of dispersants?
The first one was for a test run.
So
the other day we got that for a test and they asked for this test. Pre-approved is I just want to, I'm not trying to say there's a lot of dissension here, just have a little bit different view of what that means, because it still means we touch base with all those agencies.
So it's really, nothing's really pre-approved if you have to check with all these agencies.
The only thing that was pre-approved is we think that
the zone, this zone is more environmentally safer, or less sensitive perhaps, than this zone. In other words, zone one is the least environmentally sensitive, zone two more, and zone three the most. Now, they'll shift a little bit with the time of the year, with the season, as it's described to me. So when they come up with this, they say, okay, where are we? What do you give approval for doing this? In other words, the zones are pretty approved, but we don't have a blanket, carte blanche permission to go right now and say, boom, do it right here. We still touch base, whatever you want.
Can you describe for us the contingency plan that we've heard about that was in place for dealing with oil spills? Just
the contingency plan is required by law. It's laid out for 5 hours
response time.
I'm sorry, can you slow down a bit?
I was trying to talk the same speed as I got the question. I'm not good at that. I think the response time is not just peculiar to this agency. I think, as I'm told, that is a decree to be 5 hours about anywhere.
Yeah,
and that's laid on the terminal.
My question is the contingency plan A through Z. What?
I wish I could figure that one out.
We've heard a contingency plan mentioned. There's a contingency plan mentioned by the oil company, by the environmentalists. People are mentioning a contingency plan. I've never heard a description of exactly what it entails. I don't want to take up everyone's time.
Okay, we need to see if I can tell you. Number one, the spiller has a responsibility for cleaning the spill. That has not been shirked. It was taken on. Obviously, it was not taken on immediately because here at the pipeline, LES terminal is supposed to have a contingency plan. It's supposed to respond to any spill within up to a certain geographic point. Mm-hmm. As soon as Exxon got their forces on scene, they took that over. They started gearing up at noon. Actually, Mr. Iorosi started gearing up at 3:20 or 4:20 in the morning. By the time he got up here, it was about noon, starting to mobilize, and then at 6 o'clock, they were in full charge.
Yeah, no, I realize we've heard detailed time accounts of what happened, but what was the plan?
The plan is it's supposed to be responding in 5 hours.
I think I've said before, in 5 hours, most of the oil had bubbled out. The response has been criticized because it was something like 9 hours when they were on scene.